Welcome to Cinemakers, Amy Heckerling. This is episode 50, Look Who's Talking To, from 1990. I'm Mike Manzi.
I'm Kara Gallarica.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And so
here we are again.
So this movie, I think my big complaint is that it's not really a movie. I don't think there's really, like, plot. I don't think that there's really story. I don't know if this is me coming off such a high of the first movie, right? But, like, there's just scenes. Like, there's just things that happen in this movie. Like, it's not great. I like this, you know, in terms of our Letterboxd rankings. I gave it fewer stars than the two of you. I did not like this movie. I still like it more than Giant Dangerously or European Vacation, but I just, this didn't, especially off how great I thought the last one was, how great we all thought the last one was, this just didn't do it for me.
Yeah, I think there's a drop-off for sure. I think that it has a very rocky start to it, but I feel like it finds its way as it goes along. But I agree, it feels almost like a couple episodes of the sitcom Look Who's Talking, and I was actually pretty surprised how little talking baby there was in this one than I remembered. But I kind of enjoyed some key moments in this, and I thought it went in some interesting directions, but it's not terrific. It's not the last one, but it was, I think it was a good effort because you knew it had to happen. And since they knew it had to happen, I feel like they did the best they could.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was fine. It was kind of a letdown, but
that about sums it up.
That's the best review.
As far as sequels go, also not the worst one I've seen, but I think the, like, the core idea of, like, the baby talks only really has so much mileage to it, and then
yep.
There's not too many places that you can go with it after that.
What bothered me a little bit is that it didn't seem consistent in whether or not he could hear his sister talk, like whether or not they could talk to each other, because it feels like early on, Mikey says something, and then his sister Julie says something, and it doesn't seem connected. And in the end, they sort of have a little conversation. But I feel like if the movie's about, now we've got two talking babies, I feel like there should be more of that. Like, they should get into more wacky antics. But that seems to sort of happen off screen, sort of. Like, when the apartment catches on fire at the end and Mikey pushes her out, like, we see a little bit of that, but I feel like we could have seen more.
That could have been the whole movie.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about it last time. Like, it could have been Rugrats, you know what I mean? Where it could have been them bonding over parents they don't really understand.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like there's a couple missed opportunities here. I thought it would have gone in the direction where Mikey is now actually talking and that he can't understand the baby sister anymore. And it's, you know, and that's sort of a twist about it. And he's like, I can't hear my sister's, what's the baby thinking now? Or is just completely ignoring it, and it's all from the new baby's perspective. I thought that could have been interesting, because I was also a bit thrown with it. I was thinking now they're like, it started feeling a little sort of Village of the Damned when they're like reading each other's mind or something to me.
A very different Kirstie Alley movie about pregnancy, which I just watched this weekend.
I think that's why it came to mind. I saw that you watched it. But it's funny, my thing about what I said about the last movie was like, oh, I could enjoy this without the talking baby. Like, I think it would make an interesting film. And I do kind of enjoy the adult situation stuff and what they're going through, struggling marriage and that. I think that's interesting. You don't really see a lot of it portrayed that way very often. That worked for me more than, like, the talking baby stuff this time.
Yeah. This one was, like, a lot darker, I think, than the first movie, but it's the same tone in a way. Like, the situations in it, I feel like, are a lot darker. Like, the baby almost dies at the very beginning of the movie and is like, oh, I guess this is the end, goodbye, and then, like, winds up not dying. But to, like, right off the bat start out with, like, possible child death, like, that's a very dark movie. And I feel like they kind of kept on that darkness, like, throughout the film with, like, the grittiness of, like, early 90s New York City and, like, the danger element of it. And then, like, they almost die in a fire too, which is also crazy. But it doesn't treat it very seriously at all.
Yeah, and, like, Kirstie Alley's brother pulls a gun several times, and it's like, that was jarring. I didn't recall that. But there's those moments, and then when you get stuff like the potty monster, which I think is pretty terrific, it's like, where's all this fit? It doesn't feel like it's fitting together as well as it did the last time. They're very much like these extremes instead of, you know, sort of working off each other.
I think there's just less whimsy this time. Like, I think that there's more to enjoy and more to just sort of smile at in the first movie. Like, when this movie starts off once again with the Ova traveling down the fallopian tube, I'm like, oh, it's the same thing. Like, I know that there was like a year or whatever between these movies, and we watched them 5 or 6 days apart. So, like, it's less time, but I still feel like, oh, this is just like a blatant retread. And Kara, I'm sure you read, I don't know if Mike, if you knew this, but this is not a movie that Amy Heckling really wanted to do, that the studio was like, hey, let's make a sequel. And she's like, all right, like, I think we already told the story, but like, all right. And so here we are. And so she made this movie. And I think there are maybe kind of some interesting ideas here that weren't in the first one, but I feel like the heart isn't in it in a way that the first one, like, she had this beautiful idea for a first movie that's a bizarre, crazy, weird idea that worked maybe better than it should, but whatever weird alchemy was on the first set, it worked really well. And then this time, I don't know what her demeanor was like on set, but from what I read, it just seemed like, yeah, she didn't really want to do this, and I think that you can feel that it's just, there's not that creative spark here that there was in the first one that really makes it's something like, you know, unexpected and new and sort of like, you know, wonderful to watch.
I hear that, definitely. Like, I kind of felt like we were in a little bit of trouble even before the opening sequence when the TriStar horse in the logo talking like Mr. Fucking Ed. I was like, wait a minute, I really don't remember that happening. Like, this is going for something else. And maybe that is, maybe that was thrown into kind of for Amy Heckerling to be like, you know what, I'm really just going to tear the shit out of this or something. Like, I'm gonna take the piss out of this movie, like, right up front and let the viewers know that, like, I'm not on board with this. But it's an extremely short movie too, right? So, like, there isn't really a lot in here. You can tell, like, there's this kind of the leftover ideas from maybe the last script, you know? Like, maybe the brother was supposed to make an appearance the last time and there just wasn't room to fit him in, and, you know, other things, like, with the best friend and stuff. But for what is here, though, I mean, it was I just feel like she kept it together, at least, like, to me, it plays fine. Like, at least it plays. Like, it's not unwatchable to any degree or anything like that. And there's actually some nice new directorial touches that I noticed. Like, I really kind of enjoyed what she was doing, or whoever she hired to do the stuff with the color in this movie. Like, that really kept me watching, you know? Like, that was entertaining, and I was like, okay, I could track this throughout the movie, and that's something to keep my attention and keep me busy and stuff. And then, as always, waiting for Travolta to start dancing. That's always great in this movie.
Which happened way too late in this one. There was not enough Travolta dancing.
Agreed.
But when he dances, it is great.
You know, it should be illegal to cast him in a movie and not make him dance.
It's like people think, like, Sam Rockwell dances a lot in his movies. It's like, you know, that was Travolta's thing first, I guess. I knew he was a big dancer, but I forgot. Like, he really is in every movie busting a move.
You know, Mike, what's weird? This movie is really short. It's only 82 minutes. You mentioned how quick it is. Apparently, when it aired on TV, there were deleted scenes that they added in.
Interesting.
Like, there were scenes where Molly threatens Mikey with a spanking if Julie runs away again, or he takes Julie away again. There's a running gag where she thinks that John Travolta is cheating on her, and she even imagines him as John Lennon.
She imagines him as John Lennon?
Imagine all the people cheating on you, I guess. But, like, there's all these, like, weird things that I guess were cut for a reason. But I guess when you have to fill, say, 2 hours on ABC Family, so back then, you gotta add things in. Otherwise, you don't want to have, like, 40 minutes of commercials. But still, like, it's weird to basically be like, hey, here's a repackaged version of this movie that you thought you watched with stuff that wasn't good enough to make the final cut.
I'm just glad we're not as obsessive as our early days when we would have tracked that down and watched it too and made Kara watch it as well. And, like, those days are over. I'm glad not knowing that exists.
Yeah, there are in this one, like in all of the previous movies, some really good dream sequences again. And I'm like curious to see that John Lennon one, because it sounds like another one of these weird dream fantasy nightmare sequences that she's so good at directing. Like the Big Brother, like, baby dream sequence.
Oh, a punk rock baby?
Was there a punk rock baby?
Is that the one when he defends his sister on the street from the other baby?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the whole thing is just weird and kind of nice and wonderful. And it's George Harrison's song that they use. And then there's a later Mikey dream sequence that is set to another George Harrison song. I found that interesting because they use the Beach Boys twice in the other movie. And I am just curious if, like, they did that for a reason.
They call each other Elvis and Priscilla a lot in this movie as sort of pet names to each other. Did you guys catch that too?
Well, they mention Elvis a couple other times too, like not even just calling him Elvis. And then they have, he dances the Elvis song, and like, it just seems sort of like a running gag or something.
Well, Elvis was actually the first choice to play Danny Zuko in film version of Grease. Like, they actually wanted to cast Elvis and Anne Margaret as Danny and Sandy. Obviously, it would be a very different movie made at a very different time, because he actually died the day that they shot the sleepover scene in Grease.
Oh, you talked about that on the podcast, I think, right? Yep, I remember that. Yeah.
So I think that Travolta has, like, a weird Elvis parallel in his career.
They've also got the same, but I don't think they look alike, but they got the similar hair, the similar sort of swagger. They could be, I guess, cast in the same type of parts. I mean,
and moving those hips.
Yep, the hip shaking.
And moving those hips. You know, at some point, Mike, you and I might watch every Elvis movie, ahem, ahem. But, you know, I don't know. Like, I feel Travolta is not the closest thing we have to Elvis, but in ways, the closest thing we have to Elvis.
Yeah, I think he pulls it off enough. Like, I could see him playing it. Kurt Russell actually played Elvis at one point in a John Carpenter movie, no less, way back in the day. But I could have totally seen Travolta, doing the king at one point. Maybe he still will play the king. I mean, he could play Fat Elvis or whatever right before, and it could be that scene. Oh man, how crazy would it be if he's playing old Elvis and he's at the audition for Grease and he's auditioning as Danny Zuko and there's someone else playing Travolta, like, in the corner going like, Elvis, great to meet you. Oh my God.
Like Aaron Tveit, who was Danny Zuko on the TV broadcast or whatever.
That'd be crazy. I'd love to see that.
So this movie is notable in that it, once again, I believe, made money. I don't know what the budget was. I would imagine, you know, the budget of the first movie was about $7 million. Doesn't seem like there's budget listed online anywhere, but it made close to $50 million domestically. So it wasn't the worldwide sensation that the first one was, but it still made its money back. However, it was also lambasted for being a bad movie. I don't know if you looked these up, but it was nominated. So we know about the Razzies, which was nominated for Razzies, which I will get to in a second. But it was nominated for Worst Picture at the Hastings Bad Cinema Society's 13th Stinkers Bad Movie Awards in 1990.
That's up for bad titles for bad movie awards.
Truly. But you know what one, quote-unquote, one Worst Picture that year, Mike, was a movie we're going to be covering very soon. The Bonfire of the Vanities, the Cruise Club movie, which also stars Bruce Willis.
I think I'm going to be on that episode, right?
Is that Tom Hanks? I think Cruise is the firm and Hanks is the bonfire. But that is Bruce Willis as well, so.
Hold on, let me take a look at this. Bonfire of the Vanities, 1990. Drum roll, please, while this loads. Oh, it is Hanks, you're right, and Carrie, you are going to be on that, so, whew, okay. So, get ready for that. But, of other sort of kind of significance, in the Razzies, I don't agree with this. Like, the Razzies, you know, it is what it is, but this film is nominated for 2 Razzie Awards for Worst Supporting Actor for Gilbert Gottfried.
Oh, that's more of like a cameo.
He's barely in this. It's just, yeah.
I think he's great in this.
I think he's just great, period.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then also we're supporting actress for Roseanne Barr, who barely has anything to do in this. Like, she's not good.
I mean, does that count? Does a voiceover count as worst actor? I mean, the baby's adorable, and, you know, I actually was like, we mentioned last time, I wish it was like Joan Rivers. Roseanne is doing like a very understated version of her, you know, normal shtick here. Like, she's very low energy for Roseanne. I was not remembering it this way. I was like, this is fine. I can handle this level of Roseanne. But I would have, now thinking about it, I wish they would have gone with someone who isn't a comic like they did when they went with Bruce Willis originally. And maybe they could have gotten more out of it that way if they had someone who wasn't so much used to being in a comedy. And not that Bruce Willis wasn't in Hudson Hawk, one of the greatest comedies ever made before this. But, I mean, you know, I'm just saying.
Hudson Hawk is truly great. But neither of those actors won the Razzie. The worst supporting actor went to none other than President Donald Trump. Ugh. In a movie called Ghost Can't Do It, which, do either of you know this movie?
I've never heard of it.
So Bo Derek was in this movie that on IMDb has a 2.3 out of 10.
Oh, no, Derek.
Yeah, Bo Derek. She is a perfect 10. Elderly Scott kills himself after a heart attack wrecks his body, but then comes back as a ghost and convinces his loving, young, hot wife, Kate, to pick and kill a young man in order for Scott to possess his body and be with her again. So that sounds terrible. Trump won Worst Supporting Actor for that. It was also nominated for Worst Picture, the Razzies that year. And then also, like, again, this is not, you know, something that I agree with, but you talked about at length with Brian that Sofia Coppola, Domino herself for Godfather 3, was nominated for Worst Supporting Actress and won Worst Supporting Actress for Godfather 3 that year. So I feel like that one, you know, I'm in agreement with you that she's not as bad as people give her credit for, but at least with that nomination, if you hate her, it's like, okay, she's in a lot of that movie. Here, Roseanne has like 20 lines, maybe 30 lines, and she, you know, it just feels like a different kind of ball game they're playing.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, they're very choosy with what they want to award. I'm trying to wonder what role did Trump play in that Bo Derek movie? Did we ever
didn't look it up. Don't really care, but I am interested in it.
Don't really care, but like if we're gauging these by screen time, yeah, what are the qualifications? Like, yeah, I want more specifics.
I wanted this movie, like, I love the first movie so much, and you know, we are also today, Mike, I think we mentioned, we sort of teased it last week on this show, but you and I are also going to talk about the sequel to this movie, which, according to Letterboxd ratings, is even worse than this. Look Who's Talking Now about Talking Pets. So we're going to talk about that on your show, Third Time's a Charm, which we have not recorded yet, and I have not seen that movie yet. Have you seen that movie or no?
No, I've not seen it in its entirety as of yet.
So it's another short-ish one, I think. Like, the thing I will say for this movie is that it is short. It's 82 minutes, but it feels longer than that. Like, it feels long. Like, it feels like Johnny Dangerously felt long for a 90-minute movie, you know?
But it wasn't as bad as I was expecting it to be, because I had listened to the How Did This Get Made episode that came out about this, like, not too long ago. And so going into this, I was like, oh boy, this is going to be a real letdown. And, like, having that expectation, I think, helped going into this, because I was like, this is going to be really bad. And it was just fine. It wasn't terrible. You know, so it worked out to like a net positive, I think.
I didn't see this one in theaters, but I did see it a lot. And I don't remember liking it as much as I did the first one either. I do now like the little things that it does try to go for, like potty training and exploring that and talking to their kids about their bodies and real issues like money argument and being the breadwinner and literally not knowing whether your paycheck is going to come from. And like, you know, maybe there's too many of that kind of thing going on here, but it's kind of nice from time to time just to see like a family drama / comedy, you know, tackle some real issues once in a while.
Yeah, and the whole thing with her brother and their like clashing values and difficulty negotiating that. One thing that I realized, and this kind of ties back in with what I was saying before about this movie being a lot darker, is that there are a lot of Taxi Driver references in this movie. Like, Travolta refers to her brother at one point as Travis Bickle, and the actor that plays him looks so much like a young De Niro. It's kind of crazy. There were like a few more that I picked up on while I was watching it.
Well, Travolta drives a taxi. He's a taxi driver. Yeah.
Right. Also, there's that. Yeah.
And I also kind of thought now he becomes a pilot in this one, but he's just kind of like a air taxi guy. Like, I thought that was, I was like, oh, yeah, like that's kind of, I didn't think of that. Like, when you become a pilot, you don't just start flying jets and jumbo jets and passenger airlines and stuff. Like, you got to work your way up.
You got to earn those flight hours. It is weird that in this world, it seems like everybody's profession is either taxi driver or accountant. Like, we get a couple more accountants in this, more accountant humor, which I, you know, I like. Again, it just sort of feels in the same way like a retread of the first movie, which, again, I think it's sometimes hard in this regard. I'm being overly critical of this movie because I feel like those are the kind of things that if you watch the movies a year apart, you might be like, oh, I remember those kind of things from the first movie. It might be more nostalgic in a way, but having just watched these, I'm hoping for more originality. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like, oh yeah, we just saw that and we saw it better. Or even if it wasn't better, it was new at least. And so, you know, there's that.
Yeah, I was expecting it and actually remembered it to be sort of more focusing on what it's like to raise a daughter this time instead of raising a son. But it's kind of not. Like, it's more about like being brother and sister when they get down to like the baby's talk and that kind of thing. The parents kind of like ignore the kids in this movie quite a lot, I feel. I think like that could have been strong if they're like, okay, now we're just going to really dive into the differences here of having a daughter.
But I think they're, both of them are still too young for like the gender differences to really be that stark or that.
Maybe that's another issue too. Maybe Mikey should have been a couple years older and we picked this up down the line a little bit.
Great makeover montage, though.
I love that. With the daughter chomping down on brushes and stuff, too.
Yeah, that was so cute. But also, as I was watching it, I was like, oh my god, this is where the, like, well, one of the makeover scenes in Clueless comes from. It's the one where Cher is, like, getting ready before Christian comes over for their date night where they're gonna watch some, like, It Hot and Sporadicus. And Cher's trying to figure out what to wear, and she's like, oh, I'm so nervous. And she's, like, standing there with her dress, and she's holding her hair up in the mirror, and she makes this face. And Kirstie Alley does the exact same pose in that scene. It made me excited.
You think that's a pose that Amy Heckerling does in real life? Or is that a pose that every woman does? Or is that just an Amy Heckerling thing, do you think?
I don't know. I've never tried on clothes that way, where they're just like holding it up to their body. Like, why would you? It looks completely different when it's on you.
But I feel like that's a very movie thing to do, just sort of in general, right? It's just like, let me lay this on top of me.
Yeah, she also does a big hair flip where she's like leaning forward and all of her hair is forward. And then she throws it back over her head. And Cher does that in Clueless, too. You guys, I'm so excited to watch Clueless.
Next week.
Kara, I thought of you again because this time they went even more in-depth into the eyebrows.
I know. What's the deal with eyebrows? I don't remember who said that, but I wrote down the quote.
It's the baby girl's, like, one of her first monologues is about, like, what are these things? Different sizes and shapes, and what are they even for?
Yeah, I just, reading the quote, it sounded to me like something that Jerry Seinfeld would say. What's the deal with eyebrows?
What's the deal? You know, speaking of early monologues from the baby girl from Roseanne, we had in the first movie, Bruce Willis calls his penis a third arm, and here she calls her vagina a second mouth, which I guess it is gross. Like, that's just, let's do the same kind of joke, but like, what does it look like? What would a baby think it is? Another mouth. And just like, whoo, okay.
The baby puppet this time was
terrifying.
Yeah, I know.
It also feels like, I know there was the umbilical cord, you know, wrapping around its head, that which is why she has to have a C-section, which we talked about why, you know, the baby almost dies in the beginning of this movie, but it also kind of looks in a weird way, and maybe I'm just inspired once again by your Halloween costume, Kara, but it sort of looks like a Persephone, like, crown of thorns in a way, like around her head, just this goddess of the underworld in a way. Like, I feel like that was not at all what they were going for, but that's what my brain saw, so that's something. There's no need to respond to that. I'll transition in a way to, there is a restaurant that was opened apparently in this world called Eat Me Raw.
Yeah.
So, okay.
They were going to serve all raw food, but people thought it was a porno theater. What an idea.
I feel like we're sort of already kind of out of things to say. We could play Penis or No Penis, everybody's favorite game show.
No, thanks.
This is where I learned what a diaphragm was. I guess that's something, because I was, what, 11? So that was before sex ed, I guess. I don't know. Someone had to construct a gigantic one for the purposes of filming.
This is the second movie in a row where Kirstie Alley has a painful labor-induced fuck, mm-hmm. where she drops that, or she is sort of, it seems like, demonically possessed by her contractions.
They completely skipped over her finding out she's pregnant.
It feels like a lot of the first act was condensed. I feel like she was supposed to be pregnant for a bit longer.
Because, I mean, when you find out that, like, a human being is growing inside of you and you didn't mean for that to happen, that's a kind of, like, a big deal, you know? I feel like for the movie to just, like, skip over it was weird.
Well, I feel like, you know, the movie is 82 minutes long. I guess they can't spend 30 seconds on that scene because then it would be 82 and a half minutes long. I don't know. I'm just disappointed. You know, I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed in this movie. That's all I've got to say about it.
So this movie marks the second time I caught a Stallone joke.
Yeah.
There was one in Johnny Dangerously where there was a sketch that says, is this Johnny Dangerously? But it was a sketch of Stallone.
Yep.
And then there was another gag in this movie, so I don't know what their deal is with Stallone, but it's hilarious, whatever.
And also, kind of close to our heart, just as a real quick aside, this is the same year that Rocky V came out, so he was in the news for, and I think that was also nominated for Worst Film at the Razzies, so
go for it.
A rough year to be Stallone, maybe. Although, you know, Mikey does correctly identify him as penis, so.
That was very funny. Amy Heckerling also seems to have a thing with captain's hats, because Kirstie Alley's father, who's Amy Heckerling's father in real life, in this movie is wearing a captain's hat. It's actually a black baseball cap, but it says captain on it. And then in Clueless, there are several sailor hats in that, and even talk of sailor hats and captain's hats. So I don't know what that's about, but it's definitely a thing. The costumes in this were also really great, I thought. They're kind of subtle, but still like very stylized. And good set dressing too, that just like feels very Heckerling.
Would we say that the triumvirate or the trifecta of Amy Heckerling directorial flourishes are cool soundtrack, cool clothes, dream sequences? Those seem to be the big three so far.
I would add a fourth, which is backlighting. She uses like a specific lighting technique a lot that's very kind of like old Hollywood, where you'll see that they're kind of outlined in light because the light that's on their back is actually brighter than the light that's hitting them on the front. I've just noticed that it's shown up in most of the movies that we've watched so far, that is just like a lighting technique that she seems to be quite fond of.
Are we out of things to say about Look Who's Talking To already? Because I feel like I am.
Possibly.
I already closed my Word document that has my notes in it, because it's just, I got nothing, guys.
I thought Travolta looked pretty good in this. Like,
oh, he looked thinner, right? He looks like he lost weight. Yeah.
Yeah. He was really in shape. Like, he was really moving around and dancing and stuff. And I just loved Kirstie Alley. Like, she's just a great presence, I feel, on screen. Like, I like how she can make her voice crack. And
she's so good at crying.
She's just very, you know, expressive in that way. Like, she uses her arms. I like the way she, like, does that. Like, you're saying, when she flips her hair, I scrunch her face up at times and stuff. She seems to be having a good time too. So like, everyone, that's the thing too, like, I get the feeling like this might have been kind of fun, or everyone at least was like getting along and everything. It's just too bad that there wasn't more to work with.
But one thing I did want to point out, you mentioned how good Kirstie Alley looked. I don't know if you mentioned this earlier, Kara, in when you were talking about her costuming, but she wears a pair of glasses in this movie that are like gigantic, and not like comically gigantic, just like early 90s, late 80s gigantic, and they just look incredible. Like, I don't know how to describe them other than they are just like a third of the size of her face, and they just look great. Like, she's got these like really, I guess, current at the time, but feeling today, old school glasses, which I, you know, eyeglasses, reading glasses, whatever, that I really appreciated. So good on you.
I'm frantically Google image searching, looking for it right now.
I also noticed, Joey, I don't know if you picked up on this, at the end they have like a nice Fast and Furious style barbecue where they're all together as a family.
I don't think I noticed it, because I think by that point I was checked out. But, you know, I do appreciate a good barbecue to end a film, of course.
There's also a little post-credit thing, too. It ends with Mikey and his sister walking away, and then it freeze frames, and it fades to black in the credits roll, and then it comes back, and she falls down, and she goes, ow, my tush.
Huh. Was that before the credits, or that was after the credits?
Yeah.
Man, I did not catch that, I can tell you that much.
I've been watching credits. I don't know. I've been conditioned by Marvel now.
Yeah, I like fast-forwarded through them. I didn't see them. Maybe I bailed too early. I don't know.
One more thing about Look Who's Talking To. In the How Did This Get Made episode, they talked for quite a while about this weird basket that they have hanging on the inside of the door in the apartment. And so watching the last movie, I had my eye peeled for these basket doors. And what I realized is there's actually two different doors in this apartment. I had to draw like a whole mental map of like the layout. It took me almost the entire movie.
I noticed that in the first movie, because you remember when in the first movie Travolta wrestles with the baby's father?
Yeah.
And like they completely destroy like the entrance.
Right. And it's like a little hallway kind of. Yeah.
Yes. And Kirstie Alley walks in there and she's like, oh, what happened here? And he's like, oh, Albert was here or whatever. And then she forces, you know, Kirstie Alley kicks Travolta out of her apartment, and he leaves through a door that is
in the kitchen.
Yes.
And that's the door that they use most often. But I'm just gonna send you some pictures.
Wait, but hold on. In the meantime, I found, take a look at that. Look at those glasses.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Those are some killer glasses.
I've been cleaning out my garage, and I've been coming across all types of glasses that I used to have that I've just, you know, when they broke, I threw the frames in a box, and they are some ugly glasses that I used to wear back in the
We all wore ugly glasses.
Like, these are, I mean, I know this is the 90s, But, you know, I guess, I don't remember if it was one of our podcasts or another podcast or whatever, but basically, you know, like 1990 is sort of the ultimate summation of the 80s, and like these glasses that she's wearing are very 80s. Like I'm not exactly like that, they are basically a third of her face. Like it is, they are huge. And
no, yeah, she looks like an X-Man, like she's a Cyclops.
She also looks like a scientist with goggles on, like they're that
size.
That's
it, right? You know? Yeah, that's a better call.
Anything else we want to say about
the baskets? So they have these weird baskets. So in the little hallway, on the little hallway door, there's a totally normal basket hanging on the inside of the door with like papers in it and stuff. Normal ass basket. But then the door in the kitchen has a weird, very shallow, round basket on the back of the door, like flush with the door. And then in this movie, there is a different basket, and it's a rectangular basket. It's a much bigger basket, and the way that it's positioned on the door just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I'll send you some pictures eventually. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Mike, we got another hour to talk about this franchise sometime soon, releasing today on the Cage Club Podcast Network. Is there an adaptation of this? Is there a book?
Not that I could find.
Thank God. Well, I mean, the important thing, though, is we've made it through. We're not halfway done with Amy Heckerling, which is a little sad. We've gotten through. Hopefully the back half is better. I think between Clueless and Red Oaks, generally speaking, we're going to have at least as much good stuff as the first half. But, you know, next week, the big one, Kara's favorite movie of all time. We've talked about it maybe in every episode so far. Next week, Clueless.
I am listening to the audiobook of a book called As If, which is an oral history of the making of Clueless. And it's so good. There are entire chapters just based, like, just about the lighting and just about the production design and just about the costumes. It is a dream. I'm learning so, like, I had no idea that I could even learn any more about this movie, and there's so much to learn, and it's been such a joy. Joey, did you know that Justin Theroux actually auditioned to play Paul Rudd's part?
Oh, Kevin Garvey? Wow. I love him.
This is going to be like a two-parter episode, I feel. it's going to be an epic one.
It might.
Oh, also, Amy Heckerling directed at least a handful of episodes of the Clueless TV show, right? So we're going to see if we can get our hands on those and watch those. Are those out on DVD? Do you own those?
No. I bought a DVD of the movie, though.
Of course. I don't know if I have one, but I should buy it because that is a delight of a movie.
It truly is. I was also worried, like, oh, is it going to, like, really hold up when I watch it this time after we've spent so much time talking about this stuff? And, like, we already covered it on Wistful Thinking and whatever, but just reading this book, I know that I'm going to have so much fun when I watch it again. And, you know, as we record this is Election Day, and I'm feeling a lot of dread, and this is kind of keeping me afloat. So thanks, Cinemakers.
Well, that's kind of the whole reason, not the whole reason why we have the podcast, but, you know, a reason we're doing the podcast so fervently is because, as I think you said in an earlier episode, Kara, real life not that great, movies, a little bit of an escape.
Mm-hmm.
But for all things Cinemakers, and also all of our other 22 shows in total, if not more by now, who knows, I don't know, go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or @cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Oh, I'll say this here this time. Go to cageclub.me/newsletter. Sign up for our free monthly newsletter. I email it out on the first of the month, every month, never more often than that. Keep abreast of what's going on in our network, the best of the best. I feel like this show, unlike any other, has the most sort of variation in when it starts and ends and who we're covering next. So if you like the format of Cinemakers, I'm also curious to know, email cinemakers@cageclub.me. Are you listening to the show? Mike, do you think that people are listening? Again, we don't know. I see download numbers, but I don't know who these people are. Do you think people are just tuning in for Amy Heckerling, or people are on board for all of Cinemakers? Like, I don't, what do you think? What? Just what question mark?
I hope, as I do with the rest of the shows on the network, that we sort of reel someone in with one show and they discover, like, all the other shows and what's going on. You know what I'm saying? So, like, maybe someone's here for Amy Heckerling and they're like, oh, I like Steven Soderbergh. Like, I'll check out some of those episodes. And, like, oh, these guys also do Zac Efron podcast, or one of them at least does. And then there's all these other shows on the network. Like, let's see what's going on over here.
I hope so. I know that we've had a few crossover fans. So, you know, we do have, as this comes out, like 750 or close to 800 episodes, maybe, somewhere in there. I don't know exactly where. But we've got a lot of shows, a lot of movies, a lot of things that we've covered and talked about on cageclub.me. Poke around. It's all free. As far as I know, it's always going to be free. So just go find things. If you have a big movie, there's a chance that we've covered it. So go search and just listen, and I hope you enjoy. Email cinemakers@cageclub.me. Let us know that you're listening. That's all we got. Oh, wait, sorry. Kara sent it through a couple pictures of these baskets. These baskets are real weird. They just don't seem practical.
No. Why are they there? I mean, the first one seems kind of decorative. Like, it's an interesting weaving or whatever. The second one, that's just a regular-ass basket that's hung on a door in a really weird way.
And this is the same door, yes?
Yeah, so that is the door in the kitchen. I also have a shot from the first movie where you kind of see both doors. So Travolta is standing in the little entryway, and so on the left you see the main door, and then on the right it's kind of hard to see, but that's the door in the kitchen, and there's like a wall between them.
You know, I don't like this from a former apartment dweller, former apartment renter. I don't like having two doors to the outside. Like, no wonder that they have a burglar. Like, you gotta guard so many entrances.
But they come through the window.
I know, there's even more entrances.
I don't know. I don't think this was, like, this seems to be an actual place, you know, like an actual apartment. Maybe fire the location scout.
You know what I wonder if, because the basket's in the same place and the door, like, I wonder if that door, one thing I will give this movie credit for, and I know that we're wrapping up and this is a conversation we maybe should have had earlier, but I like that both Travolta and Kirstie Alley and Bruce Willis, they're all back. You know, Olympia Dukakis is back. Like, everybody's back from the first movie. It feels like the sets are still there. I mean, I know it's only a year apart. Maybe if they're using the same set, maybe there's like a hideous mark or something on the door.
Yeah.
And they just need to cover it up, and they lost the basket in between movies, but the door is the same. And they're like, oh, we need another thing to hang there. It could be something as dumb as that, but really, who knows?
Or the first basket was just there in the first movie, and then in the second movie, they were like, let's get a different weird basket. How funny would that be? No one's going to notice. And now at least two podcasts people have talked about it.
Well, there you go. So go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, and @cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email cinemakers@cageclub.me with your basket thoughts. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Kara Gill-O'Regan.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And we'll be back next week with Clueless right here on Cinemakers.
Goodbye!